We've now reached stage 9 in our tour of the Sermon on the Mount. And if you've been with us in these previous 8 weeks, you'll know that we've been taking a look at what Jesus is saying to us about our behaviour, and in particular our behaviour in the workplace as we go about our daily business. By now, we've covered a lot of ground and come across some fairly well-known landmarks in terms of biblical passages and phrases. And nowhere is that more true than today. So we're told to take the plank out of our own eye before we can remove our brother's speck of sawdust. We mustn't cast our pearls before swine. We've got to ask, seek, and knock, and the door will open because no father will give his children stones and snakes to eat. And then finally, the best one of all, we're told to enter via the narrow gate and do to others what you would have them do to you. All pretty familiar phrases if you've been around church for a while, and as usual, far too much to do justice to in the 15 minutes or so that I've got. Now, clearly, there's a sermon in its own right in each one of those phrases, but actually what's most important is how they knit together in the overall context of the Sermon on the Mount. So what I want to do today is a little bit ambitious, but I want to look at the specifics of the passage and at the same time set it in the context of what's gone before, as I think that'll help us see the wood from the trees and at the same time illustrate the full force of what's being said, because there is an awful lot in this passage that's really important. So if we start by recapping the context, I guess everyone's got a slightly different take on how you unpack the Sermon on the Mount, and you'll probably have seen that as the different speakers have come and gone these last few weeks, but they're really all a variation on the same theme. The way I see it is the first thing we read back in chapter 5, verse 1, is that Jesus is on a mountainside teaching his disciples. And then he comes out with a series of assertions. So given that we've got Matthew here writing primarily to a Jewish audience, immediately your mind should head off to a different mountain, to Mount Sinai, and to the Ten Commandments given through Moses. But these assertions, or beatitudes as they're called, they sound very different from those original commandments. And they talk about the state of the heart, not just about what we do. And when Jesus moves on to the familiar old commandments in the rest of chapter 5, he takes the disciples so much deeper than the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, as he points to the sinful heart as the root cause of breaking those commandments. And then at the same time, he says strange things to them, like, you're the salt of the earth, and you're the light of the world. So overall, he's talking about far more than how they behave here. He's talking about who they actually are as people. And yet, at the same time, he still insists that he hasn't come to abolish the law and the prophets, but he also adds that he's going to fulfill them. So there's quite a lot in there. But when you put it all together, what you've effectively got is Jesus saying, look, the teachers of the law have totally missed the point. I am going to fulfill all that the law and the prophets have pointed to. And as my disciples, you're effectively going to be the new teachers of the law. But you're going to be radically different from the old ones. You're going to live out the law in a way they don't even contemplate. So, you know, you can imagine the disciples sitting there, taking it in, and the crowd listening on, and not really having a clue what he was talking about. You know, he'd have been speaking with such authority, and they may have been drinking in his words, but making sense of them at that moment in time would surely have been beyond them. Because on the one hand, Jesus was taking the commandments, which were already beyond the reach of ordinary mortals, and making them even more impossible. And yet on the other, he's telling this motley crew of fishermen, tax collectors and the like, who were nothing like the morally upright teachers of the law, that now they're the light of the world. And of course, the confusion that his disciples were experiencing then is no different at all from the dilemma that we face now as Christians, trying to live up to his call to be the light of today's world. How can we possibly do it when at the same time Jesus is exposing the darkness in our own hearts? And of course, if we're too blind to see the darkness in our own hearts, all you have to do is read verses 3 to 5 of today's reading, and we realize it's only because we've got some planks in our eyes preventing us from seeing the real truth. So that's the dilemma that runs through the whole of these chapters, and we'll come back to it later. But first of all, I want to take a look at today's passage very briefly, just at a basic level, before slotting it into the overall context. Now, if you want a simple statement of what today's passage says, it's all about judgment. Firstly, we've got don't judge. That's broadly verses 1 to 6. And then secondly, ask the true judge. That's really verses 7 to 14. So firstly, don't judge. What does that mean? One thing it doesn't mean is don't make any decisions or don't make any judgment calls. So I don't want anyone going back to the office and saying, sorry, I'm not allowed to answer that one. There was this bloke at church this lunchtime who said that, you know, if we make judgments, we'd be judged. So I'm not going to say that. No, that's not what the passage says. And you don't actually have to rely on common sense to tell you this. You can actually see it clearly from the passage itself. Because in verse 6, we've got this very enigmatic phrase, which about not giving dogs sacred things or throwing pearls to pigs. And there's a load of different interpretations on this. But one thing it says with absolute certainty is that exercising discernment is actually vital for the Christian believer. And then immediately after today's passage as well, the same point's made. If you look on to verse 15, Jesus tells his disciples to watch out for false prophets. So again, we've got the exercise of judgment and discernment being called for there. So it's clear he's not talking about basic decision-making. But then look at verse 2. That gives us a bit of a clue. Is it judgment of people that he's talking about instead? To a degree, yes. But again, you may be a manager at work, or you may be in recruitment or personnel, and you just got to make judgments on people. And again, if you go back to verse 6, it seems to imply that we need to work out who the dogs and the pigs actually are. So clearly that's not the full story. The real clue is if you look in verses 3 to 5, because what Jesus talks about there is comparing yourself to others. And of course, the whole of the Sermon on the Mount is to some degree a thinly veiled attack on the Pharisees and teachers of the law, who were constantly trying to look good in the eyes of others. So surely don't judge means don't be judgmental. Don't be self-righteous. Don't look down on others. And don't complain about others. You know, sure, they may be a pain in the neck, but you're actually just as bad and just as much of a pain in the neck as they are, probably. So, don't be judgmental, is what it says. Nice and simple to say, not nearly so easy to do. And clearly you could do a whole sermon on this if you wanted to, but I'm afraid that's going to have to wait for another day. So don't judge, Jesus says. What should we do instead? We should ask the true judge. Verse 7, we're told we should ask, seek and knock. And then verse 8, we're told that everyone who does this will receive, find and have the door opened. Then as we go on to verses 9 to 11, what we see is the generosity of the Father in heaven being revealed in all its fullness, in all its glory. So what we've got here is the total opposite of the judgmental, self-righteous, one-upmanship of verses 1 to 5. And instead, we've got the extravagant generosity of our Father in heaven, which we're called to reciprocate. And of course, that's why we arrive at verse 12. So in everything do to others what you'd have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. So the simplest way to look at it is this. The way we overcome a judgmental heart is to ask God to give us that same generosity of spirit that he has in our dealings with others. And this, of course, operates at a pretty personal level. For example, your boss may well have shouted and screamed at you this morning. May not have done, may have done. I don't know. Or they may just have landed a pile of work on your desk just before you left, even though they know you've already got a massive great pile already. Or on the other hand, there may be a person in your team or a colleague who's got it in for you and he's constantly, or he or she is constantly sniping behind your back. What Jesus is saying here goes well beyond the not complaining about them, which is part of don't judge. What it's saying is come to God and ask for his generosity of spirit in that situation. So he's asking us to take a really positive step, not just avoiding the negative. And ultimately, of course, that includes extending genuine forgiveness where this is needed. So it can start going quite deep, quite quickly. And again, I haven't got anywhere near the time to do justice to it. But the one thing that is clear from this passage is that this will only happen, receiving this generosity will only happen effectively by actively seeking the Father in heaven, which of course speaks of prayer. And yet there is the clear promise that if and when that happens, his provision will be experienced. So don't judge and ask the true judge is the simple summary of today's passage. But if you stand back a step, you can see that from verse 7 onwards, Matthew's account is moving well beyond just giving us the antidote to a judgmental attitude. It's actually starting to bring to a climax everything that's been said in these last 8 weeks from the beginning of chapter 5 onwards. And you can see this most clearly in verse 12, where he says that do to others what you would have them do to you, sums up the law and the prophets. So we're in a summing up stage. And in fact, you can read verses 7 to 11 as the antidote to any of the wrong attitudes that have been talked about here in these last 9 weeks. So you've got that. And then the other thing you notice is that if you look carefully, the language of ultimate judgment starts to creep back at this point. Back in chapter 5, there were lots of blatant references to ultimate judgment on people. But by chapter 6, it's a little bit more under the surface. Yet as soon as we hit chapter 7, it's back again. And it's almost as if he uses the reference to judgmental attitudes as the catalyst for bringing it back in. So in verse 2, we're told, for in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And that then paves the way for these classic verses in verse 13 and 14. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So if we're going to grasp the full force of what's being said here, we've got to grapple with this issue of judgment in verses 13 to 14. And yet at the same time, we've also got to unpack a little bit more verses 7 to 11 than we've done so far. I'm going to do this pretty quickly, but as I do it, I hope that you'll see the jigsaw pieces of the Sermon on the Mount starting to fit into place. So going back to verses 13 and 14, it's actually very stark, the picture we've got here. It's like you're at the airport waiting to fly off on holiday. But the thing is, there's only two gates. Behind one, there's a plane for Barbados. And behind the other, there's a plane for Glasgow, let's say. Now, no offence meant to any Glaswegians, but it's a no-brainer where I prefer to go on holiday. And yet, there's all these people dressed up in their shorts and T-shirts, all flooding towards the Glasgow gate. And in the end, the longer you sit there, you get to the point where you think, well, surely they've got it right, and I must have it wrong. But the truth is, you're not mistaken. Wide is the gate, broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many, many enter through it. And the devastating thing is that the consequences of going through that broad gate are far more serious than finding yourself in Glasgow, where you'll actually find plenty of nice places and plenty of nice people, including our training director as well. So apologies to you, Craig, if you're listening to this. Behind that broad gate is a horrible place where you never want to go and you can't escape. So we should desperately want people not to go to that place, not even our worst of enemies. And we must do all we can to explain to people that they're heading to the wrong gate. But the really mind-boggling thing is that most people will totally ignore you. And going back to verse 6 again with the dogs and the pigs, the clear indication is that in some cases, there comes a time when it's wiser to keep our God-given understanding to ourselves because people are just refusing to listen. Now, I trust most of us here have actually worked out which is the right gate to go for. And yet then, of course, we go straight back to the dilemma we talked about earlier. You know, you say I'm the light of the world, Jesus, but how? How can I be the light of the world when you expose the darkness in my heart? And of course, if I still have this darkness in my heart, does that mean that I haven't gone through the narrow gate at all? Well, no, not at all. But it takes two or three steps to see why. Firstly, let's just remember what Jesus says all the way back in chapter 5, verse 17, when he said he'd come to fulfill the law. What does that mean? Well, if you fulfill something, it means you complete it, you satisfy it, you meet the requirements. And it means to the lawyers here that all the potential penalties of breaking the law are set aside. So that's the first bit. Then what's the narrow gate Jesus is talking about? Well, surely it's him. And he knows full well that he's going to fulfill the law by dying on a cross. And when he dies on the cross, he satisfies the demands of the law. So as we come to him and accept the forgiveness he offers, we go through that narrow gate and find ourselves on the road that leads to life, free from the penalties of breaking the law. But we still go through that gate as sinful, broken people. So how then do we find ourselves as the light of the world when we still find the darkness in our hearts, which leads to further law breaking. Well, now we can go back to verses 7 to 11. Now, there's a parallel passage in Luke's Gospel which makes it a little bit clearer. If you want to look it up later, please feel free to. It's verses 9 to 11 of Luke chapter 11. And you'll see that it's virtually identical, virtually word for word. But whereas in Matthew's version, he uses the phrase good gifts twice to emphasize the similarity between what God gives his children and what earthly fathers give to theirs, Luke tells us it's the Holy Spirit that God gives. So all of a sudden, you see the bits of the jigsaw falling into place. Jesus' fulfillment of the law allowed the Holy Spirit to be released at Pentecost, to live in the hearts of those who believed him. So what you've got here in verses 7 to 11 is actually nothing less than the promise of Pentecost. Everyone who asks, seeks, and knocks will have the door of Jesus open to them. And as they do, the good gifts of the Holy Spirit are released into hearts to transform lives. So that is how the disciples were going to be the light of the world. And that's how we now, too, are the light of the world. It's because the Holy Spirit dwells in our hearts as Christians. So as people see us, they see Jesus, and they see God the Father through him. But by the same token, it's only through the Holy Spirit that people see Jesus. So having gone through that narrow gate, verse 7 tells us there's still a daily battle of asking, seeking, and knocking, not to secure our entry to life at all, but so that God's light can shine more brightly over the darkness that still remains in our human hearts. And conversely, if we resist the work of the Holy Spirit, the darkness in our hearts will increasingly subdue the light of the Spirit. And as a result, the world around will find it more difficult to see the light of Jesus. And that's why Jesus is so determined to show that obedience to his commands is just as relevant now as it's ever been. It's the hard evidence of the salvation that he's already won. So the ultimate battle is won, but the war's not yet over. And so what we're left with is two questions. Firstly, I guess that most people here have gone through that narrow gate. But if you have, how actively are you continuing to ask, seek, and knock on the door so that the Holy Spirit shines through you more and more, revealing Jesus to an unbelieving world? And then secondly, it may be that there are some here who know that they haven't yet gone through that narrow gate. You may even see yourself as still sitting at that airport terminal trying to make up your mind. Now, that's not a bad place to be. The fact that you're here today suggests that Jesus is actually beckoning you to him. But the problem is that by default, at this point in time, you're actually heading still through that broad gate for Glasgow, because that's the consequence for those who fail to heed Jesus' call. The good news is you don't have to go there. You can still go through that narrow gate. But you've got to do something positive about it. You've got to come to Jesus to ask for forgiveness. And he promises that everyone who genuinely does that will receive what they ask for. So if that is you, do feel free to come and chat with either myself or Charmaine. Or if you've come with a Christian friend, I'm sure they'd be only too happy to chat to you as well. But please, whatever you do, do something. It's one decision that you mustn't ignore. And in the end, it's the most important judgment that you're ever going to have to make.